The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Gilbert King. His latest book is Bone Valley, a true story of injustice and redemption in the heart of Florida. He joins us on the telephone in Brooklyn. Welcome back to the program, Gilbert.
Good to be back, Vic. How are you doing?
Very good, Gilbert.
Good.
I've noticed a trend. You seem to like to write about bad stuff in Florida, Gilbert.
I know. It's the state that just keeps me coming back with the stories. I can't get away from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last time I had you on the show was in June of 2018.
Oh.
And I understand a couple of months after that, some judge came up to you and foisted his business card on you. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was the summer of 2018. I think it was August. And I was, I go around and do a lot of public speaking. I get invited to, conferences, legal conferences. And then this time I was in Naples, Florida, and I was invited to a judicial conference. All the Florida circuit judges were there. And, I was talking about my past books in Florida. And at the end of my talk, I was signing books at this table, and a judge came up to me, and he handed me this business card, and on the back of it, it said Leo Schofield, his prison number, and then it said, in quotes, "not just wrongfully convicted, he's an innocent man." And I remember that I just looked at it, and he just kind of motioned for him for me to call him. And I remember I went to dinner later that night, and I was talking to some public defenders, and I said, I showed him the card. I said, what do you guys make of this? I just was given this by a judge. And they all looked at it and passed it around the table. And they were like, wait, a sitting judge gave that to you? They're not supposed to do that because there's various ethical canons that they're supposed to follow. And he was basically saying that, Florida got this wrong. There's an innocent man in prison. I called him back, I think, the next day. And he walked me through the case of Leo Schofield, and he said, he was framed. I can tell you exactly how they did it. And at that point, I was like, never got a tip judge before, was telling me about a story of a wrongful conviction. And so that's how I started on this, project that's led to this book. It's many years later, but it all really began at that hotel in Florida at the judicial conference.
Well, at the time, you were working on something else, and you were a little reluctant to look into this, weren't you?
Yeah, I'm always kind of really suspicious about these because I get letters from lawyers, and sometimes their defendants themselves are writing me. And, a lot of times they're just not my kind of case. Sometimes they'll say, I got a tax fraud case for you. And I'm like, I don't really do tax fraud. I need to have a murder in there, for me to be interested. But this particular case was interesting to me. Just because, it was set in the 80s. Usually the stuff I do is back in the 40s and 50s. And, this was a case that, didn't happen that long ago. I mean, 30-something years ago. And most of the people were still alive. And that's something I'm really not kind of used to. I'm used to kind of dealing with dead people and documents. And so the fact that there was, people alive who lived through this, because they were all pretty young at the time, I was kind of curious. But on the other hand, I ended up telling the judge, I said, look, I'm kind of working on another book, and this is interesting to me, but it's going to be a while before I can get to it. And I could tell he was just really exasperated by that answer, and he kind of at the last second said, do me a favor, just read the transcript, just do me that favor. And I think I kind of said to get him off the phone, to be honest with you, I said, yeah, okay, go ahead and send me the transcript, I'll take a look. And I did stay true to my word. I started looking at it shortly afterwards, and I got more hooked. I was reading this. I'm not a lawyer, but I could tell something was wrong. The case didn't make sense to me, and I was wondering, how is it possible that this guy got convicted? Because I feel like I read a completely different trial. And so that's when I sort of went back to that judge and said, all right, you got me. Let's talk about this case.
The book is Bone Valley. A True Story of Injustice and Redemption in the Heart of Florida by Gilbert King, who joins us on the program. As we read the book, we discover near the end, as we're following the timeline of this situation, that the judge's frustration was something that had been going on for a long time. He had tried to intercede on his own, and I don't want to talk about that at this juncture. But let's talk about Leo Scofield Jr. What did he supposedly do?
Well, he was accused. Well, I should set it up this way. In February of 1987, his wife disappears. She's on her way home from work. She calls Leo and says, "You know, I'll be there in 10 or 15 minutes." And so Leo's a heavy metal guitarist in Lakeland. He's about 20 years old, and he's at band practice. So he's just waiting for his wife to show up, and she doesn't show. And, like, the next day comes, the next day, there's no sign of her. And on the third day, you know, friends and family looking, they found Leo's wife, 18-year-old wife, Michelle, stabbed to death, and her body was found in a canal in Lakeland, a phosphate pit canal. And but, you know, Leo was out with friends and family searching the whole time. He's kind of got an airtight alibi. So, like, they couldn't really charge him with anything because he was cooperating with police. He was constantly calling police. And they had no evidence connecting Leo to this crime. So they didn't really know what to do for, like, a year and a half until finally a prosecutor got involved. And he went back and looked at it. And he said, got to go to the husband. And he starts building a case against Leo. And so ultimately, about a year and a half after Michelle's murder, Leo Scofield is arrested and charged with this murder. And so, you know, he's always insisted on his innocence. But, you know, sometimes you have a really powerful prosecutor able to build a case. And, you know, Leo ends up going to trial for his life. They're going to send him to the electric chair. And so that was the situation that Leo found himself in, you know, searching for his wife and then mourning her death. And then all of a sudden, a year and a half later, he's actually charged with the death.
And as we're reading this, we discover just what this prosecutor was willing to do. Tell us about his tie clip.
Oh, yeah. So he's, you know, in Florida, I had the death penalty, obviously. And he's very much of a homicide prosecutor who likes to get those murder convictions and send his defendants to death row. So he wears this tie clasp. Which I don't think people really wear anymore, but it's got Old Sparky, Florida's electric chair, on it. And the first time Leo sees that is he's being extradited back to Florida from where his family lived in Massachusetts, and he glances over in the airplane seat and sees that shining electric chair, and that's pretty much what he's facing now. He's absolutely terrified by this, and he's terrified by this prosecutor who's come all the way up to Massachusetts to bring him back to Florida to face the electric chair.
There were a lot of complications here. One complication was that Michelle's body was discovered by Leo's father, Leo Scofield Sr. Another complication was the fact that a lot of people that were around the trailer park where Leo and Michelle lived heard them fighting, and Leo had a temper. And this didn't help him, did it?
No, it was really used against him in a pretty horrific way because, you know, what ended up happening is when they start the trial, the state offers 21 witnesses in a row, and the majority of them just get up there and just say, oh, this guy's got such a temper, you know, he's punching walls a lot. One time he threw his guitar into a bonfire because he was mad at another girl that he was dating. And so, like, they just opened up with what they call this bad character evidence. And usually in these kind of situations, the courts will kind of step in and say, all right, this is getting a little bit cumulative. You got 21 witnesses coming up talking about his bad temper and, you know, fighting with his wife, but there's no evidence of involvement in any murder. And so normally the prosecutor is required to file what's called a letter of intent or a notice of intent saying, I'm going to bring these witnesses forward. I have 21 of them. And usually the defense will step in and say, that's kind of overkill. Judge, can we get it down to two or three maybe? But in this case, the prosecutor didn't file a letter in advance, and Leo's lawyer, Jack Edmond, didn't object to anything. And so the judge let it all in. And so one witness after another for the first couple days is just testifying about Leo's bad character. And because Leo's lawyer didn't object, it was never really part of the record. They couldn't challenge it anymore in an appeal. It had to stay. And so Leo really, I mean, there's a lot of people I've shown this trial transcript to, and they said, this was over before the defense even got up there. Like, already they hated him. The jury must have hated him, because this is one witness after another. And so that really didn't help. And, you know, Leo was, you know, known to have, like, these really screaming matches with his wife. You know, they were newlyweds, but they were just learning to live together. And so you had these, some lawyers or some neighbors were complaining that they, you know, they heard a lot of fighting over there. And all of this just pointed to Leo.
He knows he's innocent. He can't believe that this is happening. And he's got so many strikes against him. He's got the lawyer who isn't doing his job defending him. He's got the prosecutor who is determined to put another notch in his death row notch list. Leo, when he was interrogated, his demeanor wasn't very much in his favor. We've got the complication of his dad finding her body. And it ends up that Leo gets convicted, and we find out later in the book that he could have been sent to death row if not for someone on the jury. And that is just, I'm not going to give away what happened, but that's just an amazing thing to read about that. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO at 91.3 on your dial, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. We need to take a quick break, and then we'll continue with Gilbert King talking about Bone Valley. And if you've ever heard of a podcast called Bone Valley, you might know about this story already. We'll be right back. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined by Gilbert King, and we're talking about his book, Bone Valley, A True Story of Injustice and Redemption in the Heart of Florida. Leo Schofield Jr. was innocent, but they convicted him anyway, and he went to prison. And in Florida, once you're in there, it's kind of hard to get out, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it really is. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's this mountain you have to climb. Like, before your trial starts, you're innocent until proven guilty. But once you're convicted, you become guilty until proven innocent. And it just really shifts a lot, like, in order to get new evidence in there. And so Leo just, like, you know, he goes through the appeals process and just gets nowhere with this. He tries to do an ineffective counsel motion about his lawyer who, you know, forgot to object to a lot of different things that really doomed Leo. And his lawyer actually ends up falling on his sword and saying, you're right, I didn't understand the rules of evidence. I didn't provide effective counsel. But the judges end up ruling against that too, saying that's Jack Edmond. He's a famous judge, you know, like he's not incompetent. And so they rule against that. He never wins anything. He keeps trying to get this into the courts, based on, you know, regular appeals and ineffective counsel, and just has no luck with it. And that was kind of the way his whole trial went, if you look at it. You know, you mentioned earlier about the father. You know, on the second day, the second night after Michelle went missing, they found her car broken down on the side of I-4, about 7 miles outside of Lakeland, 7 miles away from where her body was found. And so the whole search party starts searching backwards from that car, because there's really only one route to get back to the payphone there she called Leo from. And so they're basically all split up and they're searching, and Leo's father ends up finding Michelle in a drainage ditch off the side of a road. And, but you know, he says something like after he finds the body and the police come, you know, they ask him, how did you find her? And he says, well, God must have been leading me there. You know, I had God's help some way. He was phrasing it like that. And that ends up getting used against Leo, because they said, well, the father must have had, you know, prior knowledge of where that body was, because there's no way he could have found it on his own. And so, you know, they use that against him, sort of this innuendo that, you know, he just went out in the middle of nowhere after waking up and having this premonition. It wasn't a premonition. It was just something he said after he found the body, which is kind of fairly common if you look into a lot of true crime cases like this. You sometimes have people finding the body or important evidence, and they reflect on it and they say, well, God must have been helping me. And that's what ended up happening. But it got used against Leo really badly. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in the trial that just sort of, you know, this innuendo and hunches that really didn't amount to any evidence. They had no evidence connecting Leo to this murder. But, you know, there's a very good prosecutor, John Aguero, the man with the electric chair tie clip, going up against Leo's lawyer, who's really not prepared, didn't do any preparation at all. And so, yeah, the verdict was really not in his favor. He was convicted of his own wife's death.
And this prosecutor was a genius about building narratives in cases, whether they were based on facts or just what he wanted to build, like the husband did it. That was part of the narrative. And it turns out they had the evidence. They were aware of the evidence of the real perpetrator right from the start, but it didn't fit into the prosecutor's narrative. And this is not just the story of Leo Schofield Jr. and his many years in prison. This is also the story of the real killer and his many years in prison and his role in getting Leo out of prison. This is just incredible.
Yeah, I have to say this is the most interesting part to me because, you know, for me as a writer, somebody who investigates this, it's really important for me to, like, be on the ground. So I have to be around all these people. One of my heroes is Brian Stevenson. And, you know, he's got this great line in his book, Just Mercy. Like, if you want to understand injustice in America, you have to be proximate. And what he really means is you can't just be, you know, in an office looking through documents. You got to be down there. And that's what I really did. And it was really important for me because Jeremy Scott, his fingerprints were found in the car that Michelle was driving right away, but they were unidentified. And because Florida didn't have a fingerprint identification system that was, you know, digitized yet, they were just unidentified fingerprints for like 17 years. And finally, they were able to run them through the APHIS system, and there's a match. And, you know, it doesn't come back to a tow truck driver, like whose fingerprints are in the car. It comes back to a known killer, somebody who's, you know, serving a life sentence of his own up in northern Florida, who we believe has killed four people. And so all of a sudden these fingerprints come back to Jeremy Scott. And that became a big part of the story. I felt like I had to talk to him too. I had to get his side of it. And, you know, I think that ends up turning into one of the most important parts of this entire story was that I was interviewing not only Leo Schofield, but I was also interviewing the person whose fingerprints were found in the car, who was believed to be the killer. And I think, you know, if you listen to the podcast, you can hear the voices of both of these men. And I tried to, you know, really bring that together in the book as well, because I ended up having, you know, a fairly close relationship with Jeremy Scott, who ultimately confesses to killing Leo's wife and basically takes responsibility for it. And I think that's what made this story so different.
My guest is Gilbert King. His book is Bone Valley, A True Story of Injustice and Redemption in the Heart of Florida. I'd like to mention the fact that I presume you usually work solo on these projects, but in this case, you had a very valuable person working with you. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was using a researcher. I had a researcher that was starting to work on the new book that I was working on. And I remember one time she was in my office and she picked up the Leo Schofield file that I had gotten from the judge. And she was like, "What's this?" And I said, "Oh, this is this guy in Florida who claims to be innocent and he's in prison. He's been in prison for like over 30 years. And I was trying to, you know, decide, her name is Kelsey Decker. And I was trying to decide what project to put her on. And she was like, "Well, those other stories are all history. Like, this is a guy who's in prison now and doesn't belong there. That should be the priority." And I remember just sitting there thinking like, yeah, that's right. Like, that should be the priority. Well, I could do the history anytime. And so she was really interested in the case. She started reading. She got ahead of me and started doing a lot of research in that case. And, you know, she's not a trained lawyer. She was really just out of college. But she was seeing the same things that I was seeing. And so, you know, we both got really invested in this case. And she was there for the whole way, just like an invaluable researcher. But she ended up, you know, doing a lot of the sound recording. And her style, she just grew throughout the whole project. She was actually doing a lot of the interviews on her own. And so having, you know, the ability to work alongside with Kelsey was just really beneficial for the project, because I think we just kind of fed off each other's enthusiasm the whole way through.
That really comes through in the book.
Yeah.
Jeremy Scott, we read about him and we learn about him and we think about these potential murders. We wonder, was this guy a serial killer? Is this guy a serial killer? This is a guy who belongs in prison. And yet, when we learn about his past and where he came from, we feel some sympathy for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hardest thing. And honestly, I like to make a point of, like, I wasn't trying to create any sympathy for him. I think the sympathy that people feel for him, not only his background, he suffered horrific abuses and rejection in his family growing up, but I think, like, the only person who really cared about Jeremy in this whole story was actually Leo. I mean, Leo is the one whose empathy for Jeremy was, like, really surprising. And, you know, it's really complicated, but, like, after Jeremy confessed, they brought it back into the courtroom. And at this point, it was argued by the prosecutor that you can't believe a word Jeremy says, because he initially denied killing Michelle, and now he's saying that he did kill Michelle. So he's clearly lied under oath. And so they made a case that he's not credible. He's not a credible witness. And ultimately, the court ruled that Jeremy was not credible, and Leo was denied a new trial. And at that point, this is like 2017, Leo's been in prison for like almost 30 years at this point. He's just in a really dark place. I mean, he's got no more legal avenues to challenge anything. He knows that a known killer's fingerprints are found in his wife's car, and he's confessed to the murder, and the courts will not believe him. And so he's kind of out at the end of his rope. And he ultimately, because he's the pastor at the prison's God Behind Bars program, Leo ends up coming to this realization that this bitterness and this anger is going to destroy him. And the only way he can really find peace is he has to find a way to forgive Jeremy and let this bitterness and anger go. And it's really difficult for him. You know, he told me, he said, you know, I would go into this place, they called it the war room. It's basically a closet where they prayed. And he said, I'd go in there and I would just tell God that I forgive Jeremy. And he says, and God knew I was lying, because God knows everything. But I said, I'm still lying, but I'm going to keep coming in here and keep saying this until you make it true in my life. And that's what he does. And he starts praying and praying for Jeremy and learning to forgive him. And it's a sincere forgiveness. Leo is very clear about that. He says, I can't forgive her, Jeremy, for Michelle's family or anybody. I'm doing this for myself, because I'm going to be destroyed by this if I don't come to terms with it. And so he really, like, seeks out God's help to get him through this crisis. And really, that's what saves him. And kind of what really makes this story really interesting is that Leo's empathy for Jeremy Scott, you know, realizing that this person he'd been chasing, this monster for so many years, wasn't a monster at all. He was just like this pathetic person who's, like, you know, living in and out of foster homes and juvenile facilities and rejected by his own mother. Like, it wasn't the monster that Leo had been searching for. It was just this, you know, kind of broken teenager that, you know, really just was impulsive and had some brain damage and a low IQ. And Leo couldn't really find himself to hate this person. He had to choose a different path.
So here's Leo in prison for a crime he didn't do. He's been in there for decades, and he's eating himself up with hatred when he knows who did it. The courts won't give him any relief. They won't help him. They won't believe the confession that Jeremy made. And he decides he's about ready to kill himself, but he decides he's got to change his view of Jeremy. And the two heaviest moments in this story to me as a reader, The first one is the first time Leo accidentally comes upon Jeremy in prison, and they see each other. And the second one is when you're with Leo and Jeremy calls you on the phone.
Yeah.
Unbelievable moments.
Yeah, and, you know, there was just a lot of moments like that, you know, throughout the story. I mean, you know, Leo tells a story, and I remember it was the very first day that Kelsey and I went into the prison, and he started to talk about the war room. We ended up spending like 3 hours with him that day. And, he says, when I went back to court, this is in 2010, he knew that the fingerprints matched up to Jeremy Scott, who was a known killer. And Leo was like being walked under the tunnel. There's 33 men going into court, and they're all handcuffed two by two. And Leo is the odd man out. He's got nobody cuffed to him. And as they're getting close to court, he sees another inmate come in with a guard in handcuffs, and they're bringing him up to the line. And Leo's thinking, that's Jeremy Scott. That's the man that I think killed my wife. And they're about to handcuff us together. And he's like, that's just a line you cannot cross. And he was just going through this thing like, if that happens, I can't get justice for my dead wife. I'm just going to end it myself. I'm going to just jump on him and do this. And he's having this like fantasy of what he's going to do. Finally, at the last minute, they realize what a mistake this is. They go, pull him back. Got to keep these two guys separate. And the guards yank Jeremy Scott back, and Leo just lets out this huge sigh of relief. And that moment really affected him because, you know, he said to me, like, you know, I'm not a murderer, but I felt like in that moment I could murder the murderer of my wife. And that's what this prison made me. That's what this system made me. And that's when he really was reaching out to God, like just saying, I got to protect myself from this. Like it's, I don't want to be changed as a human being. And I'm going in bad places. And so ultimately a little bit later, they're in the cells down in the basement, and he sees Jeremy sitting there, and they called Leo's name to bring him up for his appearance. And he has to walk by the cell where Jeremy is. Jeremy's pretty violent, so they have to keep him in his own cell. And he looks at Jeremy and he says, know that I know, Jeremy. Know that I know. And he said at that point, Jeremy didn't look at him at all, didn't acknowledge him. And he said, at that point, I knew for a fact that I was staring at my wife's killer. And that was just a really poignant moment for Leo. Like he was finally convinced that this is the guy that did it. The relationship between these two, starting out as just, you know, total strangers to Leo, like actually caring for Jeremy. It was just really remarkable for me to witness.
So powerful. The book is Bone Valley, written by Gilbert King. And there's going to be an event on April 22nd. That's a Wednesday at the Victoria Theater in Dayton. Gilbert's going to be here. And Leo Schofield Jr. is going to be here. It's another evening for justice, 7 o'clock, April 22nd. And ticket information is available if you go to DaytonLive.org/events/justice/. That's DaytonLive.org. For ticket information, you can go for another evening for justice. And you can hear Leo speak. You can hear Gilbert speak.
Mark Godsey will be there. He's the director of the Ohio Innocence Project and really just somebody I deeply admire. Met him several times and done some panels with him. And just the work he does in Ohio is just, he's just one of the leading advocates for the Innocence Project throughout the country. Judge Steve Dankoff will be there. Wrote a phenomenal book called Extreme Cruelty, which, believe it or not, is one of Leo's favorite books. Leo loves that book. He constantly quotes it. I travel around the country with Leo. We do a lot of talks, and he's always talking about Judge Dankoff's book because that really resonated with him. You know, it's all about judges' accountability in the wrongful conviction sphere. And Leo has just really taken it to heart. I think he's become Judge Dankoff's biggest advocate. He just loves that book.
We've had Judge Dankoff on the program for that book, Gilbert.
Oh, you have? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
We need to take a quick break. Gilbert King has joined us, and we'll return right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been joined by Gilbert King on the phone in Brooklyn. We're talking about his book, Bone Valley, A True Story of Injustice and Redemption in the Heart of Florida. I mentioned the podcast. You mentioned the podcast. Trying to get a podcast was kind of a frustrating experience for you, but it ended up turning out okay, didn't it?
No, it really did. I was new to podcasts. The reason we picked is it was actually Kelsey's idea again. After we got out of visiting Leo, he was just such a dynamic storyteller and just so passionate and committed to his story and justice. And I'm somebody who's used to dealing with documents and mostly dead people. I don't really get to interview a lot of living humans in the history work that I do. But like coming out of there, we were both like blown away by his storytelling and sharing these really intimate moments of his life. And, we recorded it. And Kelsey said, we should do a podcast on this. People need to hear his voice. And at that point, we said, I really think that's a great idea. Like, because we've been listening to like some really, really powerful podcasts, like In the Dark, that went into wrongful convictions. And I recognize the power of that medium, just hearing the voices and the storytelling, and kind of took it on as a challenge. Like, even though we don't know what we're doing, let's try to figure this out. So Kelsey learned how to do all the recording equipment, and we just started working on it, and we gathered all this tape, and then tried to put it together to bring to podcast companies, and that was really hard too, because people looked at it and they would say things to us like, well, he's in prison the whole time, he never gets out, so I don't know if he can sustain a narrative. And I remember thinking like, have you ever read a Russian novel? This can be done. Like, I know this can work as a narrative. it was challenging. And, then we ran into COVID, so like nothing was really happening. But it enabled us to keep doing research. But I was always convinced. I said, we have an unbelievable story here. Just nobody knows it yet. We just got to get it in front of the right people. And ultimately, we got it in front of Jason Flom, who has a show called Wrongful Conviction. And he's very committed to this. He's one of the founding board members of the Innocence Project. And I said to him, you got all these great interviews with people who have been exonerated, but you don't have a story of someone who's innocent who hasn't been exonerated yet. I think I have a story for you. And he was familiar with my past writing, Devil in the Grove especially. And he basically looked at the proposal and said, when can you start? And I was like, it was the easiest pitch of my life because they were so committed these wrongful convictions, and they already were familiar with my work. And so I've been with them ever since. I mean, Jason and his company, Lava for Good, is just, they're perfect for me because they understand this fear, the wrongful conviction and the justice fear. They're committed to this. And so it's just been a great partnership for me. And I love working with these young, talented producers who just really elevate the game. I'll just tell you a funny story. Not knowing anything about podcasting, during the pandemic, I said, well, can't do anything else. I just might as well start working on some scripts. And I put together some scripts and ultimately gave them to the producers. And they just, they're like, yeah, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner, but you do not know what you're doing with these podcast scripts. They're terrible. And I love the fact that they were able to tell me, like, you got to start over. We got to work with you. Because I didn't know what I was doing. And they had to really teach me how to write for like a podcast or broadcast. It's a very different form of writing. You're kind of writing around the good tape that you have. And so having to learn that was really challenging. But now I really am beginning to really understand it. So, I got an education from much younger people who had more experience in this field than I did. And that's just been really fun for me to deal with, just taking on these kind of new challenges.
Another key aspect of all this is the fact that Leo miraculously met someone while he was in prison and remarried. Tell us about her.
Yeah, and that's Chrissy. And this is like another part of the story. There's a lot of parts that are hard to believe in this story. But, after being in prison for a few years, Leo is sort of encouraged to get an education. He gets his GED. He never graduated high school. He starts getting college degrees. He starts really educating himself and working in the system, trying to make himself the best possible inmate so he can someday get out. And so he gets a job in the prison as a teacher's aide. And there's a woman named Chrissy Carter, a couple years older than him, who is teaching a life skills class, and Leo becomes, you know, her teaching assistant. And believe it or not, they fall in love in the prison. And, you know, Leo doesn't want to be one of those guys who's, like, trying to convince, you know, a woman that he's, you know, innocent. He just doesn't want to do that. He says, look, you can look into my case. I'll tell you I'm innocent, but I'm not going to push it on you. But if you want to do your own research, feel free, and I'll answer any question you have. And so that's kind of the tact that he takes with Chrissy. And Chrissy takes him up on it. And, you know, she is remarkable. She starts going to the clerk's office, looking at the case files, reading the transcript. And she does this for years, coming back to Leo with more questions. And she's the person who gets hung up on these unidentified fingerprints. And she's the one that actually persuades a friend in law enforcement to run the prints. And they come back to Jeremy Scott. So I always feel like Chrissy was like the unsung hero in this. She's the one that really discovered the most important evidence. And, you know, it got revealed 17 years later after Michelle's murder. And so, yeah, they've been married ever since. I mean, Chrissy is just so important to Leo's story. And, you know, I can't say enough about her. She's just this remarkable woman who just, you know, her friends called her a dog with a bone. Once she gets onto something, she just will not stop. And that's definitely the Chrissy that I know. Like, she knew Leo's case just as well as anybody else, and she was a great go-to person for me. Whenever I needed something, I needed files, she goes, oh, I got those. I got them for you. Don't worry. And she would send them to me right away. She was just really just, it's such a pleasure to work with people like this who are really committed to it, and there's nobody more committed than Chrissy.
The book is Bone Valley, A True Story of Injustice and Redemption in the Heart of Florida by Gilbert King. Near the end of the book, you and Kelsey get an interview with Jeremy Scott. They kept they kept moving him around to different places, different prisons. And you got to go into this little cafeteria and interview him. And it made you kind of nervous because, for one thing, the warden, as they were walking out and leaving you with Jeremy, they said, no, don't let the inmate touch this door lock because the inmate can lock you in with them. And also, he wasn't shackled as he normally would be. And you sat down with him, and it seemed like Kelsey really stayed on point. You kept trying to get him to talk about the actual murder of Michelle. It was something that he kept skipping over.
Yeah. You know, that's a very common theme, I think, when you do this kind of trauma reporting. And sometimes you'll see, like, people who are confessing to murders, they'll do this thing where they'll lead you right up to the murder, and then they'll be very vague about it, like, I can't remember exactly what happened. I think it's really the mind sort of protecting you and putting your defenses up. Like, you don't want to believe the very worst thing about yourself. So it's really difficult for them to say, like, I stabbed them in the heart, you know, like, or describe these things. They kind of get you right up to the moment, and then Jeremy would do the same thing. He would say, and then I lost it. I don't know what I did. I don't know how many times I stabbed her. But then I started, you know, getting her body and putting it in the water. Like, they're very clear about that, but they don't actually talk about the murder. And, you know, we experienced that same thing with him. And I think that's just a really telling thing about when you talk to people who confess to their crimes. They don't really want to get into the worst of it because it's just painful for them and traumatic for them to, you know, hear themselves say the same things about, you know, the worst parts of their lives, I guess. But yeah, he was like that. And, you know, it was kind of scary because, you know, we'd read that he had, you know, been violent. He attacked people in the prisons and was very impulsive. And usually he was like, police would go in there and lawyers, he was always handcuffed to the table. And, you know, there was a guard standing by. In our case, they just put him in the cafeteria with us, no guards, no handcuffs. And, you know, there I am, like, sitting at this table, Kelsey's sitting right next to him. And we have to go through this interview. And you know, it makes you feel like this is a man we know has killed at least four people. He's very impulsive. We don't know how he's going to react to this. But, you know, in truth, I think nobody's ever really talked to him the way we did. Mm. We weren't really interrogating him. We weren't, like, trying to, you know, like lawyers and cops are trying to get the story out of him. We kind of took a different approach. And you can hear Kelsey in it because she's has more of a therapeutic approach, and she would just say things like, how did that make you feel? And mm-hmm. what were you thinking at that moment? And Jeremy was looking at her and really responding to her. And so I kind of like took a back seat through a lot of it because she was being so effective at just getting Jeremy to talk about his feelings and his thoughts instead of like, how many times did you stab her? And you know, what did you do next? It was much more relaxing. And you could see Jeremy, you know, all the remorse that the state expected Leo to show, which he could not show because he always claimed his innocence. Jeremy was showing that remorse right there. And you could see it in his eyes. You could see his eyes tear up. You could hear his voice crack. And he would say things like, you know, at night I go to bed and I see the faces of the people I killed. That's my punishment. Mm. It's a nightmare. And you could tell how affected he was by that. And he, you know, he was very adamant. He said, you know, I don't know what else Leo did, but he didn't kill his wife. I killed his wife. And he doesn't belong in prison. That man is innocent. And you could tell him just sort of coming clean and kind of easing his conscience. You could tell he really felt bad that somebody else was serving time in prison for something he had done. And, you know, he said, I'm trying to help him, but they won't believe me. And I had a relationship with Jeremy for 4 years after that interview. And he never once recanted. He always took responsibility for killing Michelle. He always was very clear about it. He didn't want to see someone in prison for that. He wanted to, he knew he couldn't bring Michelle back, but he wanted the family to know that it was him, if that knowledge made their suffering easier. And so I felt like he was being really honest with us in ways that I don't think he ever was with police or lawyers before.
That interview was a work of art. My guest is Gilbert King. Gilbert, I know you've done a lot of interviews and a lot for this book. I have a question that, after reading the book, seemed kind of obvious to me. I'm guessing you've been asked it before. I'm a little apprehensive about asking it, but I'm going to anyway because that's my job. Do you feel like if you hadn't gotten involved that he might still be in prison?
Yeah, you know, the best way for me to answer that is to just tell you what Leo told me, which is that, you know, he would go to one parole hearing after another, and it was always the same thing. The prosecutor would show up with autopsy pictures of his dead wife, show them to the commissioners, and then just say, this man has never said he's sorry. He's never taken any accountability for what he did to Michelle. You cannot let this man back on the streets. And he would get rejected for parole after parole. I think when we brought so much attention to his case, you know, the New York Times was covering it. ABC was sending cameras into his parole hearings. Millions of people were listening now. I think that the prosecutor's office at this point decided that they just didn't want to do the same thing and just get up there and say that, you know, he's never said he's sorry. They didn't want to go through that again. So they basically just kind of coalesced around this theme of just saying, well, we have to admit he's been a good inmate in prison. We have to acknowledge that. And we hope that you treat him just like any other inmate who comes up for parole. And I think that the fact that they didn't want to keep fighting this gave the commissioners the opportunity to look at the prison record instead of this inflammatory rhetoric that was keeping him, you know, locked up. And at that point, they decided to send him to a transition house and set him up for parole. And he was released from prison after 36 years in 2024. And Leo told me, he said, if it wasn't for the story and that we changed the narrative of his case, that he thinks he would have died in prison. So he's the person that I sort of refer to because I don't know if it made a difference. I remember having a conversation with him saying, Leo, I don't know if what we're doing is going to help your case or help you at all, but I know we've changed the narrative of your case by the way we investigated this. And like I said, at least we have that. And so fortunately, because you can't count on this, it shouldn't be this way, that a story is what changed Leo's fate and got him out of prison. You know, really, it should have been in the courts. That's where this stuff should be done. But, you know, unfortunately, it took a story, and I think people believe that our story was the truth in this case, that there was powers that be decided to at least let him out. He hasn't been exonerated yet. He's still working on that, but at least he was able to get out of prison and paroled. But, you know, he still lives in Florida as a convicted felon. And there's challenges to that. He's got, you know, they wouldn't say they're curfews, but he has to check in and can't really go anywhere without checking in. You know, his AA classes that are mandatory that he has to take, and it's hard for him to get a job because of the convicted felon that, like, is sort of always hanging over him. But, you know, at least he's not in prison.
The book is Bone Valley. It's also the podcast. And if you read the book, you'll find out where Gilbert got that title. I found that fascinating. And that's a joke. They'll have to figure that out. I have a weird sense of humor. I need to give them the event information here quickly before we let you go, Gilbert. It's Another Evening for Justice. Gilbert King will be in Dayton along with Leo Schofield Jr. And it's Wednesday, April 22nd at the Victoria Theater. Another Evening for Justice. Tickets are available at daytonlive.org/events/justice/. If you go to the daytonlive.org website, you should be able to access that information if you want to attend this event. Another Evening for Justice, 7 p.m., April 22nd at the Victoria in Dayton. And I understand that he was in a terrible motorcycle accident. Has he mostly recovered from that?
I'd say he's mostly recovered. It was really bad. He broke he had an open book pelvis fracture, like legs, arms, wrists, everything. So many broken bones. He's had, I think, a dozen surgeries. You know, this poor guy, he gets out of prison and kind of reverts to his younger self, gets back on the motorcycle that, you know, he remembers driving back in the day, and somebody turns in front of him, and he gets in a horrific crash, nearly gets killed. He's laid up in bed for months and months, and but, you know, he's recovering now, and I've taken him on the road for this book tour, and he's just phenomenal in person. I mean, people are just so moved by him because he's so gracious, so full of empathy. You know, you mentioned earlier that he ends up forgiving Jeremy. Jeremy, when I was visiting him, Jeremy called and apologized to Leo on the phone, and Leo forgave him. And it was just this incredible moment between these two guys who, you know, the state doesn't believe either one of them. They don't believe that Jeremy's confession is true. They don't believe Leo's assertion of innocence is true. But these guys sort of forged it together, like in this kind of like spontaneous moment where they just both realized that they were telling the truth. And Leo talk about it is just remarkable because he's just one of the most well-spoken people you'll ever hear.
Well, Gilbert, I know that your book, Devil in the Grove, was a Pulitzer Prize winner and also a runner-up for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And I'm guessing Bone Valley is going to be nominated. And I'm wondering, is your next book going to be in a state other than Florida? Is it going to be like in Louisiana?
You would think. I did one book in Louisiana. I loved it because the food in Louisiana is great. So, like, I wish Florida had the same kind of cuisine that you get in Louisiana. That would really make it easier. But I love working in Florida. And I'll just tell you why, Vic. I get so much support, whether it's from politicians, prosecutors, defense lawyers, academics. I think people really have looked at this as a non-political way. This is just something that's not left versus right, it's wrong versus right. And people have kind of rallied around me in telling these cases. They helped me get files. They helped me introduce me to people. And the network of people in the legal community that I've built over these couple decades is just invaluable to me. So probably think I'll always stay in Florida. But I know there's some great cases in Ohio, though. That's I know about that for sure.
Okay, Gilbert. Well, thanks again for your time, and we really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Vic. Thanks so much for having me on.
My guest has been Gilbert King. The book is Bone Valley, a true story of injustice and redemption in the heart of Florida. You heard about it in the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.